Hey Larry, how are you tonight?
Doing great, Andy. How are you?
I am well. I spent the day in Atlanta. It was his birthday recently, and he had a really traumatic situation. It was obviously his time to go register, and the way the Georgia law reads is that you have to register within 24 hours, 72 hours prior to your birthday. And he lives in a smallish kind of county, and it ended up that he goes up there like 2 days prior, but that's not the day that they register. And then just the way the time schedule works out, he's then technically late registering, and he's seriously freaking out that he might end up the minimum sentences to go back to jail for a year. And it's a massive, stressful PTSD kind of situation, trying to just cover your butt that you were there, but you couldn't do all the things. And I bring this up because we have talked about a much more benign registry scheme of like Vermont, where you just send in a card. Why do you have to go in person to get booked? You could do it so many other ways.
Well, you have to do that because it's a part of the intended, invisible but yet intended humiliation of the program. That's why it's in law enforcement rather than in a see, I want to put it in a regulatory environment, which if we're going to have it something we call a regulatory scheme, I think it should be handled by, in the state of Michigan, for example, it'd be the Secretary of State. They do the motor vehicle stuff, but in my state, it'd be the Motor Vehicle Division. We would want to put it and for a clearly regulatory environment, then they wouldn't have the bureaucracy set up to do the humiliation. They would simply process you like they do when you come through to get a license plate renewal or a driver's license renewal. You would go in and hand in any paperwork and be on your way and pay your fees if there were any. Hopefully there would not be any fees for the regulatory scheme, but it's a part of the humiliation process. It's a kind of an I got you thing. If you build a 72-hour timeline, it presents the opportunity for that type of failure, because who likes to go on their birthday to be booked and to be humiliated and be degraded?
Or even still, like a longish weekend where there's a holiday, your registration day is, let's say, on a Tuesday, so you have to do it prior to, but then you have a Monday holiday and they're not going to be open Saturday and Sunday. You are screwed right out of the gate because you can't, that's 72 hours.
That is correct. Now, in the county he lives in, they're typically a lot more laid back there, and unless they're out to get him particularly, probably won't be an issue. But if he's given them any type of what they would call non-compliant attitude, and non-compliant means doing anything that they impose on you, whether or not it's in the statutory scheme, like they tell you that you have to call them when they leave that bright flower on your door. You don't have to call them unless it's in the statutory scheme. They impose these things that are not in the statutory scheme, and then if you don't go along and cooperate, then you're non-compliant. If he's been non-compliant in their estimation, then they may attempt to try to make something out of it. But in that particular county, I don't think it's going to yield any problem, but we'll find out in the coming days.
All right. Well, please consider making us part of your podcast diet. You can search for us at Registry Matters on your smart speaker or podcast app of choice, like Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts. Also, if you like what you hear, please write a review. And if you don't, just forget everything I just said. And this show is supported by our patrons. You guys and gals are amazing. You rock. And we'd like to thank our new patron, Justin. He writes, "Thank you. I've been enjoying your podcast, and I feel that you're giving out really good information and having good guests on your show that helps. So I wanted to do my part to help. And I'd like to say, so your blue ball will be in the mail on Monday. And thank you so much again."
I would say the same thing, Justin. Thank you so much for the support and confidence. It's a lot of work to put these together, believe it or not, and to receive a compliment. I realize that some people may not agree with me, and I really appreciate that you find value in what we're doing. That's the whole idea of doing the podcast.
And also, I was having a conversation with another one of our Patreon supporters, and Mike in Florida. And he says, "Hey, but keep on doing what you're doing. One thing I've learned is that this is a marathon, not a sprint. People in this world can be total dirt bags, but I know what it's like to suffer and lose it all. We need people like you educating people like me. What you're doing is important, and in my opinion, really groundbreaking and badass. It takes big balls to put yourself out there like you do. That's a total badass move, in my opinion." So thank you, Mike. And so if you would like to support us, please head over to patreon.com/registrymatters. Every little contribution helps, and we really appreciate our patrons.
What is the minimum that a person could do to support the podcast in terms of financial?
If you wanted to do $1, that would be awesome. I don't think you can do less than $1. I don't think the system allows for less than that, but you could sign
So
up at any level.
a person can sign up $1 a month if they want to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would adore it if we had 10,000 people giving us a dollar. Not to get a dollar, but just to show that the appreciation of the sport, of the show.
Well, and also show that they're out there absorbing the information that we're pumping out, which in many cases, people, this is the first time they've heard it. There's a perspective that I know I present that is completely different than what the average person who's grown up in a middle class background, largely tended to be in a conservative family. They have not heard my perspective, and I'm hoping to open some eyes. I've heard their perspective. I grew up in conservative, and I was a conservative, and I was a very conservative person at one time, and I've evolved. And so I'm hoping that as we go through some of these things and people begin to click and say, gee, I need to rethink that position. That's the whole point of this. We're not trying to belittle anyone's beliefs. We're trying to expand the universe of knowledge.
I am.
You're trying to belittle someone's beliefs?
All right, so let's move on. And I would like to welcome Rory Fleming, sorry. And you are the founder of Foglight Strategies in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I would like to give you a great big FYP welcome. And how are you, Rory?
Thank you. I'm doing wonderful. Thank you for asking. Just another day in paradise.
Outstanding. But one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on the show is that you have more Twitter followers than we do, but it also would seem that you and Larry could throw around political strategy ideas back and forth. I was just looking at some of the campaigns, and it looks like you two would be able to dig into all kinds of strategies and techniques of trying to move the ball into the direction that you want it to go.
Yeah, most definitely.
So tell us about Foglight Strategies. And the only campaign that I really was familiar with is the Genevieve Jones write in for San Diego DA.
Right, that's correct. Yes. So I worked as a research consultant on that campaign for about 5 months. So I was there almost the entire time, and it was a very exciting race. And at one point, we were pretty close in the running, with Genevieve Jones-Wright, who is a African American progressive public defender, versus the incumbent, who is now, she was the interim DA at the time. Now she got her first 4-year term, Summer Steffen, who is a quite, I would say a conservative Republican DA. A lot of chief prosecutors in California are a lot more quote unquote tough on crime than one might expect. It's, not too much of a surprise, though, if you look back to history and see how California had horrible prison overcrowding. And until just very recently, though it doesn't come into effect until 2021, one of the 4 states that had a lifetime registration for any level of sex crime, which is just terrible. And contrary to public safety. But yes, so we ended up losing that race, largely, it seems, according to the political consultant on the other side, because that was one of the races that George Soros pumped a ton of money into. And the Republican political consultant did a lot of work to poison the well on that, to basically deliver the Soros panic, so to speak. And it worked. But I think that it really generated a conversation about criminal justice reform that really did not exist in San Diego County in the mainstream until very recently. So that was cool. Otherwise, I've done work in Charlotte, North Carolina. I've done work in Boston. I'm doing work in a rural county in Wisconsin. And I have a couple of other things in the pipeline that are, a little bit a little bit sorry, confidential at the
Oh,
moment.
that's fine. That's fine. How does this are you focused on educating the candidates on criminal justice issues or in a whole broad spectrum of topics?
So it depends. Like a lot of what I do. I tend to pick candidates who I know are relatively evolved in their stances on criminal justice reform type issues. Obviously, that's going to depend a lot on area and political demography and things like that. In that some counties are more conservative on criminal justice issues than others, even with say Democrats or criminal justice reform is relatively bipartisan, but in the DA world, it's complicated. It's not so much a Republican Democrat thing, though. I've only worked with Democrats so far. It's more of a You know, all of them like punishment. Who likes punishment more or less is essentially the dividing line. A lot. So the candidates often know, though, that I work with, you know, a lot of the hot button issues right now, like which a lot of the hot button issues are going to be like bail reform. You know, there's a growing bipartisan consensus that cash bail especially is just an abhorrent system.
Right.
Of course, there's a big debate going on of what the alternative is because, you know, not everyone's happy with the idea of risk assessment models, and I completely understand that. And so so that's a complicating wrinkle, but that's one of the big ones. In a lot of the South and the West, the death penalty is a big deal. You know, in some places, juvenile life without parole is something that's come up, but also just like, you know, like obviously lighter stuff, like what do you do with just basic drug offenses? Registry stuff doesn't come up too much because it's obviously a political football.
Yep.
It's something that I've had a good bit of experience talking to people just in the criminal justice reform community, but also prosecutors and sheriff candidates and DA spokespeople and media people who have told to me in confidence, and I won't name any names, but like, you know, hey, you know, we know, like in California, for instance, there was somebody who worked high up in a DA's office was like, you know, we know that the lifetime scheme is BS. This is something that like a lot of law enforcement in California gets, but it's politically taboo and inappropriate to say, basically, because it's something that's extremely difficult to convince, general public who doesn't know about the complexities and the wrinkles in these issues, that it's something worth talking about. So I think that obviously there is some progress. Like, for instance, Jackie Lacey is the Los Angeles district attorney. That's the biggest DA's office in the country. It's 10 million people. Wow. She was the only DA in California to support getting rid of the lifetime registry and replacing it with the general 15-25 life scheme, which obviously is not ideal, but by American standards, it's a lot better than the life thing, you know?
Right, right.
And she's actually generally, she sometimes opposes criminal justice reform bills, but often she just refuses to talk about it. She is not like an ally to general reform. So in some ways, I think that was why Governor Jerry Brown in California was convinced that it was something he should sign, because I was shocked, frankly, when I saw that. She's generally, you know, known as very, quote unquote, politically careful. So that was a really a positive development, I think. And I know anecdotally from researching district attorneys across the country in my old job that I tried to find it again. I haven't found the article, but I've seen, for instance, there was a DA out in Idaho, I think it was, where he was actually doing a first-time offense statutory rape diversion with like young adult offenders to prevent them from getting on the registry for a first-time offense, which I thought was great. I mean, like, that's something that, you know, rarely is done or especially talked about in the media. I also know that the outgoing Boulder, Colorado DA, I don't know if it translated to policy, but he definitely had some media statements talking about, like, you know, I don't necessarily know. I was shocked that he said that, this thing, because I can obviously see how it's taboo, but he was talking about how, like, in the context of an article about registry requirements and stuff like that, that he considered, say, a 24-year-old sleeping with a 15-year-old is way different than, like, a 50-year-old sleeping with a 15-year-old or whatever, you know? And, like, that's something that DAs often don't say, you know? And so I was like, huh, that's really interesting. But I think that there's a lot more nuance behind the scenes, and that's why, you know, like, you know, people who work in the DA reform area, the prosecutor, chief prosecutor area, will talk about how prosecutorial discretion is such a big deal. And you know, yeah, so they have a lot of power to take cases on a case by case basis and decide like what exactly they're going to do, like divert it or prosecute it or like what charge to bring and things like that.
Got it. Hey, Larry, why don't you jump in here and toss some ideas around?
Well, he's doing such a fine job. I don't see anything to add. The the DA's race, I agree with him on the point about it comes more down to conservative versus liberal. The party label, you can sink your ship running for DA if you're too liberal for your district. And as I've said so many times on this podcast and on other platforms, it all reflects on who we are as a people. When people start demanding diversions and alternatives to prisons, they will get that. But apparently in San Diego, whatever consultant that Republicans brought in, and it was, like I say, more of a conservative versus liberal, they used their scare tactics, which they do quite well. If you go back to Willie Horton and the 1988 presidential campaign, and you can just look at time after time, they scare people to death about imaginary boogeymen. Right now, it's the flood of immigrants that are coming over the border, but it's actually at an all-time low. but that can sink the ship of the candidate that's trying to be progressive, because the people are not there yet. The people are the problem. It's not the candidate that's the problem. It's the people who bought into the nonsensical message of gloom and doom. For some reason, Americans like to be afraid of non-existent threats or minimally existent threats. With crime going down, the people are terrified of being victims when you're safer now than at any point in modern times.
Right. And I agree with that. And I think that there's a couple of interesting things that I want to say to add to that. One, with the San Diego thing, just to give you an idea of how tricky some of the registry reform stuff can be, obviously a valiant and important effort. It was really interesting because one of the things that they seized on with their anti-George Soros and anti-my candidate ads was this idea that my candidate was not going to prosecute sex crimes anymore. And like on the website that they made, the like hit website, they were basically like, "We'll not prosecute sex crimes," you know? And so all that they were riffing on there was literally that Summer Stephan is the queen of conflating sex trafficking and just normal prostitution. Which is like largely an ideological thing that has definitely become something that a lot of more conservative tough on crime DAs have seized upon as a way to justify all of their harshness. There's a lot of obviously, if we're talking about like, you know, a situation where like a gang has kidnapped somebody and they're holding a gun to their head and like being like, you know, like ordering her to like get raped all day, basically, that's a lot different than, say, you know, like an escort or whatever, you know. But like to Summer Stephan in California, that's not the case. Genevieve Jones-Wright decided to take the risky but I think important tack that these things are not the same. And it's worth looking at the data and talking to women who work in who do sex work for a living and like actually get their perspectives of what's going on. And in a county like San Diego, with a lot of conservative do-gooders or like quote unquote do-gooders, they were like, you know, they need something to dedicate their advocacy energy to. And so not even paying attention to what's actually going on with sex trafficking and just assuming that, like, you know, anything that anyone says about it is real with the panic, you know, it just like I thought that was a big thing that probably like helped sink us there. So the other thing I was going to say, too, is I think that media ecology matters a lot. And I think it's really important that this podcast exists because I used to work with the Fair Punishment Project, which is a joint project of Harvard Law School's Charles Hamilton Houston Institute and the Criminal Justice Institute there. One of the major things that we did was creating that media ecology for people to actually be more exposed in national outlets to what the criminal justice system actually looks like day to day. And we did a lot of just digging into the records of DAs and kind of just exposing like a lot of the nasty stuff that happens behind the scenes in DA's offices that just like never gets reported on. And so that's a really big deal. Because a lot of people don't realize how hyper draconian the American justice system often is.
Can you expand on that notion right there on hyper draconian?
Yeah, sure. So obviously we have, you know, one of the common tacks is that, it's something that often comes up in reform discourse, but it's also factually true, which is we have approximately 25% of the world's prisoners and 5% of the world's population. We continue to have the highest incarceration rate per capita, which is like based on like, you know, like comparing how many people are incarcerated but divided by the population. We have the highest rate in the world. And obviously it's hard to get data from Russia and China, but like, or in countries like that, but even so, like based on what we have, that's the indicator. And often you see this in individual sentencing cases where, say, I'll give you a really pertinent example. There's a case out of St. Paul, Minnesota, where it's Minneapolis area, but St. Paul's the other twin city. Right. Yeah. And so there was a case that happened that was going through the court system, and I think is still pending before the state Supreme Court. The Court of Appeals had just heard it when I moved here a couple of years ago, and it involved a African-American young man who was like 19 or 20 when he had sex with a 15-year-old girl. It was like factually consensual, but obviously a statutory rape charge. And so he got a suspended sentence, or no, it wasn't even a suspended sentence. It was probation. He got, it was like a long term of probation, which the Minnesota court system really likes. And we are one of the least incarcerated states in the nation. We're in the bottom five, but we have like tremendous and limitless probation terms. So somebody can get probation for like, you know, 30 years or whatever, you know, kind of like the federal system. And so he got like 10 years probation or something. The max prison sentence for the offense was 10 years. And then he violated probation, but his technical violation is probably the most dehumanizing violation I've ever seen send somebody to prison ever, which was he was homeless after his case. I guess his parents either lived too close to a school or wanted nothing to do with him or whatever. And he was trying to find work, but he wasn't able to. And his PO said, his probation officer said, find work so you can pay for your sex offender treatment, or I'm going to like write you up for a probation violation. And he said, I can't get a job. And so the PO says, then why don't you just sell your plasma for $40 a week or something? Like, that'll cover it. And he said, no, I'm not going to like basically sell my body for this like bogus treatment or whatever, right? And so he ended up being sent to prison for 4 years for this, which is just impossible and insane to me. I mean, like,
it is.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, you know, this is not just a problem in sex cases. You know, people get over sentenced, especially in like the South and the Southwest for drugs, for instance, all the time. And in other states, especially if they have prior offenses. But the federal system with the U.S. sentencing guidelines and such is just, you know, basically a charge is tantamount to a conviction, and you're going to go to prison for significant amount of time on virtually everything.
Right.
And I mean, that's just not how things are in like, say, Europe, by contrast, and like a lot of other nations. A lot of other countries' laws are more lenient on a lot of things. I mean, if you look at even like European murder sentencing versus ours, like a lot of countries throughout Europe will pin a murder sentence at like somewhere between like 14 to 20 years.
Right.
Whereas here we had to put life without parole as like a rubber stamp plea bargain option to tell people that it's not okay morally to kill people, basically. And so those are just like kinds of the things that I mean when I say hyper draconian. But it was really interesting. One time I talked to a reporter here who actually wrote an article about that case, and he had no, like in Minnesota, child pornography possession cases are first time offenses is almost guaranteed to be probation. Like just straight up probation, which I think makes sense. Obviously that, you know, I have actually argued in a mitigation case that I worked on in Florida with some really bizarre facts. You know, I wrote to the judge, and I wrote that this is a thing in Minnesota, and we're also ranked number one for like, you know, child quality of life or and safety or something, you know, like by like U.S. News. And I think the judge like did find that interesting. He commented on the letter I wrote in court. But my point is that like I told the reporter here who doesn't look at federal anything that nowadays, you know, if somebody happens to get federally charged with the same crime, including in Minnesota, they're looking at like 5 or 7 years or like, you know, mandatory 10 if they have a prior offense. And like, you know, when it comes to like the the very muddled law between distribution, receipt, and possession with the modern internet. You know, the feds can just charge it with like distribution and receipt and, you know, get like 15 years for a non-contact crime that, you know, even in the 1970s or something would have been seen as a thought crime. And it's obviously complicated. But the point is that, you know, there's a lot of geographic arbitrariness. There's a lot of like state federal arbitrariness, but in like every single state in the country, we're more draconian and more punitive than virtually every country on the planet, you know? And that I think says something. And I think it says something going to the point that was made about who we are as a people. I think that there is a strong desire for retribution, revenge in American culture. And I think that that's a much more difficult question on how to change that. And I think that education is a big part of that, obviously.
Go ahead, Larry.
I was going to chime in. I think that what feeds into that, there's never just one magic solution to who we are as Americans. But Americans are all about the individual, and the Europeans are more about the community.
Right.
And Americans believe fervently that they built this all themselves.
Right.
If they're successful, they don't believe that the educational system and the infrastructure and the law and order system, the clean air and all the things that makes American society work, they somehow believe that they built that themselves.
Right.
And the Europeans are much more likely, and I had a number of years of property management where I dealt with a significant foreign student population, and they could not get over the individualization of how Americans believe that it's all about them. And that was shocking, appalling to the European students. It's like, hey, we as a society are degraded if we have undereducated, underperforming, homeless people. America, I think we talked about in the last podcast, in 1970, we had eradicated homelessness for all practical purposes because we had addressed homelessness with a comprehensive of great society program. Some of them were less successful than others.
Right.
But a part of what causes us to be that way about crime is that the American who made it and who's doing okay, and you try to explain that there's poverty factors and there's the inner city, the problems of the inner city. Well, you make what you want of life, and they make these choices, and by golly, they'll live with the consequences. And they don't see the need or desire to bring that individual back into the fold, so to speak, in the community of the family. That it's just that individual mentality that really drags America down. We don't think about the benefit of the collective whole. We think about us. We're selfish.
I think that that's very true. And one thing that I actually wrote in an op-ed in MinnPost, which is kind of, you know, like it's like a political, like a bit high-minded political zine in Minnesota about Minnesota politics and related issues. I wrote an article imploring our U.S. senators in Minnesota, Klobuchar and Tina Smith, that they should support the First Step Act, which had, you know, the First Step Act is the very limited prison reform bill that is pushing through Congress slowly right now that has the backing of gosh, how am I forgetting his name?
Jared Kushner.
Jared Kushner. Yeah, I was going to say like the son-in-law. But anyway, so he had a father who was incarcerated in the federal system for some kind of white-collar political fraud-related thing. But even so, it definitely made an impact on him and his family. And so it seems that he's relatively thoughtful on these issues. And so what the bill does, I mean, essentially, you know, there's some grab bag stuff, like it means like no more shackling of pregnant women, which, you know, stuff like that. That's just like obviously awful. Why do we do that in our system? But the key provision that has been really debated is that it increases by about 10 days or so the amount of days that can be calculated as good time in the federal system until you can go into a halfway house or, you know, a non-carceral alternative to incarceration. And in the federal system, because you have to serve 85% of your sentence and there's no parole, that's pretty cool, you know. And like one of my core arguments, even though some people are really upset about potential propagations of systemic inequalities because of risk assessment models that are included. And I am sympathetic to those concerns, but essentially my argument is that because of a couple of victories of reform-oriented prosecutors in certain, liberal cities throughout America, that people in the reform community have lost sight of the fact that that's often not the reality, and certainly not the reality in U.S. Congress. And at the same time, I have this line in the article that says, to fix mass incarceration, we require a greater understanding that our prisoners, even those who have previously committed violent acts, are part of us. They are our community's children and adults and whatever. You know, there are people too. And I think in American society, you know, we do have a lot of diversity that's really wonderful, and a lot of, countries with much more humane prison systems like Sweden or Norway are, generally you walk down the street and everyone looks like you. Like, everyone looks like they could be your uncle or whatever. Not so much anymore, but that's like largely still the case. But I think that that doesn't even have to, that shouldn't be how we see things. Like it should be, regardless of similarities to ourselves, like, everyone in this nation is a part of the same, body of people, and we should watch out for each other and realize that when people commit crimes, often there are systemic aspects of how we have failed them as a community. It's not simply a personal responsibility model. And obviously, in my opinion, if we looked at it like that, I think we'd have much better statistics in terms of recidivism and things like that. But it's hard to convince people of that, obviously. But anyway, sorry if that was long and a tangent.
No, it's quite all right.
So yeah, I would agree with that. The Europeans, they don't turn a blind eye to criminality, but they go into it with wanting to better the unit, the person. And right. the American model is, we want to humiliate and degrade and punish and make the unit suffer. You can look at the Florida, or you can look at the prisons in Texas where they believe that, you can look at Joe Arpaio, the recent pardon of the president, who believes it's okay to just humiliate people to no end and make them suffer.
Give them hot water in the summertime in a tent.
And put them out in the blazing desert. Texas doesn't air condition their institutions. I think there's a few privatized ones where they might be ventilated. But that comes from the American people. If the American people were calling the Texas Assembly and saying, how dare you put our fellow human beings in this, it's inhumane to do this, they would stop doing it.
Yeah,
but that's not what they're hearing.
I think that that with sheriffs, it's interesting because Arpaio actually did get kicked out of office by Maricopa County voters.
After 30 years, yes. Go ahead.
30 years. Yeah, things have obviously changed over the decades and people finally soured them. The Soros donation to the moderate opponent to Arpaio definitely didn't hurt either. But yeah, I mean, that's just like that. There's a local democracy aspect to that. I think that people are intimidated by the giant bureaucracy of the state DOCs, the Departments of Correction. And I think that when they're not, obviously there's a lot of secrecy, but also, I'm willing to throw him under the bus again. This guy has blocked me on Facebook, but actually the entire Pennsylvania Department of Corrections has blocked, not Facebook, sorry, Twitter, for criticizing them because their chief data researcher is brilliant, but he's also like just really, really hateful, racist, disgusting guy. And I complained about it a bit, and so I got blocked. But yeah, so that DOC secretary, John Wetzel, is renowned as like a criminal justice reformer. And he does have some good things, like looking at data and trying to better the system by data, and he talks about how mandatory minimums are bad. Of course, he has limited weight on that area, but when it comes to stuff that he does have direct control over, like use of solitary confinement, solitary has actually gone up under his tenure. And like, there's still tremendous racial disparities. He's fought in court to keep all of the death row prisoners in solitary forever and things like that. like mental illness for solitary as punishment. And even so, John Jay of College of Criminal Justice will invite him to reformer conferences. And a lot of my colleagues and I are just like, why, you know? So I think that being honest about like how much better the prison system can be is definitely important, because I think there's a lot of, unfortunately, defeatism, sometimes even from the reform community, of what we can do. But of course, there is definitely that aspect of like, the, you know, like even though Secretary of Corrections are officials are not elected, there is an aspect of the public will. And like, if people did care more, they may like call up their governor or like write letters and be like, and they do to some degree, but like a lot more than they do, and be like, this is outrageous. Like, how can you not like air condition the prisons? You know, people are dying. There has been more media on the subject, though, which is good.
Before we move on, I have one last question, and feel free, both Larry and Rory. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how would you bring issues of change to the politicians to that would resonate specifically with people on the registry, particularly one that is very much not on board? I don't care whether that's left or right, doesn't matter to me, but one that isn't already on board with some kind of criminal justice reform issues.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I actually think sometimes, because and you guys may have seen this, but I have a lot. I definitely have had a lot of anecdotal experience pointing to a pretty weird, in my opinion, convergence between, you know, kind of like an identity politics driven social justice minded thing to prison reform, that, you know, it's kind of like the thing where you have to abide by all of the like liberal progressive planks, you know, like and so it's like, sometimes I think it's actually easier to bring it up to like, say, a Republican legislator behind closed doors about like, hey, like the registry doesn't make sense from a public safety perspective, than say asking like leaders in the criminal justice, the general criminal justice reform community, of like, the registry is unfair. And they may turn around and say like, you know, like shocking things about like, say, oh my gosh, like the 19-year-old who hits on a 17-year-old is a pedophile or whatever. It's like, oh my God, you know? So like, but I think that really, it depends what level you're talking on the state level. I think that, I think one thing is that, gosh, where to start?
It's a question about messaging or tactics more so than, I mean, you know, my big hot button would be about residency restrictions or work restrictions, and right. That to have somebody have any level of safety and security in society, like they have to have a job. And,
right.
And if you prevent them from living places or working places, then, well, duh, they can't function. And they end up, I mean, you know, you end up just cutting grass for the rest of your life. And that's going to be hard when you're 50 and you live in the South and it's on 95 with 80% humidity.
I think I would like to see more business owners who have hired registrants and who have had good experiences become brave enough to talk about that in the public sphere, in the legislature, and talk about how, you know, if they're maybe they had an employee once who was getting kicked out of their house because of a change in, like, say, a school was built nearby or something. And so they had to miss work. And also, like, they have, like a family, like a wife and kids. And, you know, the kids suffered. And, like, you know, like, I think that a lot of that stuff is known below the surface, but isn't, those stories aren't told, especially by people who aren't directly impacted or the direct family members. So like business people and like other folks like that. I've hired a registrant before and I had a wonderful experience. I think that that's one thing. I think that with residency restrictions, there's definitely the competing interests, and obviously this cuts somewhat on political lines, but different states have different laws about how much autonomy city and municipal units have in creating their own law. Most states have a certain, essentially, you know, for our purposes, a low bar. Like, say they could say, like, oh, the residency restrictions can be up to 2,000. And then, like, you know, all these cities, like in California, will be like, oh, okay, like here we're going to, like, draft this thing. And so, you know, obviously in California, what's happened is the city councils try to pass these things that are, you know, sometimes blatantly unconstitutional, and then advocate attorneys will go in and sue, which is great. I think that unfortunately, it's way better to be able to prevent these things from happening in the first place. I think that that's already probably going to happen because obviously other cities will look this stuff up and have a deterrent now because they know that there's been these court decisions in other areas of their state or whatnot. But I think that, when it comes to talking to, say, the legislature to change these things, I don't think the residency restrictions are going to go away anytime soon just by the political process. But I think that it's just a matter of, like, really continuing to hammer them on the fact that, like, this has no scientific benefit, you know, like, and obviously that argument only goes so far with a lot of people, but really, there are strong arguments that being worried about the, you know, person who committed a statutory rape as a young person or, like, say, looked at naked teens on the internet a decade ago versus, you know, is there any real risk there? There's studies that show that after 10 years of not reoffending, the sex offense, like, risk will effectively become modified statistically to that of a normal person. Like, you know, sorry for, I don't mean normal, but, like, you know, the the test group, the non,
the person background who, noise.
Oh, what?
The background noise. I mean, you know, you just become part of the typical population.
And so I think that those sorts of things are compelling. I think that it's important for people from both sides of the aisle to continue this discussion that's been really good about how Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is now retiring, did pen that Supreme Court opinion from 2003, that really started to just give carte blanche to the states on creating these sorts of restrictions. I believe that was the Alaska v. Doe decision. He has the quote in there that has started to be maligned in places, including New York Times and New York Magazine and stuff like that, of, like, the quote unquote frightening and high thing for reoffense, which not only did he just pull that out of, like, a pop psychology magazine, but the actual author of that study, which I think happened in, like, the 80s or 90s, he has since recanted or at least, like, said that, like, the study should be recanted. He was actually interviewed by this journalist, Joshua Vaughn, who writes at the Cumberland Sentinel in Pennsylvania, who's a really, really good criminal justice reporter. And he's written at some national outlets like The Appeal, which is a project that came out of the Fair Punishment Project umbrella, but originally. But he interviewed the guy, and yeah, the guy was straight up like, yeah, the frightening and high thing was kind of just bogus, you know. Like, I think he even, like, I think that he noted flaws in the methodology and his own, like, either personal bias, or I think that, like, maybe he had some kind of monetary bias. Like, I think that he may have been some kind of, like, sex offense therapist or something. So, like, it was more business for him, right? Like, if that was the case. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it's definitely worth hunting that article down. And the point is, like, you know, and that's not just him. Like Patty Wetterling, Jacob Wetterling's mom, has also been like, you know, the registry has, like, completely become this, like, bureaucratic monster that has, like, way over-encompassed, like, groups that, like, should have never really been on this in the first place. And it's, like, completely life-destroying and there's no restraint. So I think that, I know that's a lot of, like, dancing around the question because there's no easy answer. I think that I know I do my part by talking, like, trying to tell as many people as I can who, like, have some kind of, you know, level of potential sway. So, like, my wife is a doctor. And so sometimes, like, if these sorts of conversations come up, like, I'll make sure to educate the other physicians because they're science minded people. They're rational and reasonable, even though, like, you know, obviously, like, you know, if we're talking, like, a sex offense, like a violent rape or something, that offends, like, everybody, you know. But, like, they're also willing to look at the data, you know. And I think that that's really, I don't know how to convert that into political action, but I definitely think that talking to people who may not immediately seem like they could be helpful for the political process, especially if they have some kind of like medical or psychological credential, because so much of the registry is like, as an idea of something that's okay to do to people, is based on these false, unscientific ideas about risk and lack of mental capacity for people who have committed any kind of sex offense to stop, which is completely not true. But like, I think that like trying to talk to those sorts of people and getting them involved, including if they don't have somebody like who's a loved one or a family member or a significant other who's directly impacted, could be really helpful. Because I think that, unfortunately, and it's not fair, but I think that a lot of legislators, and I say this from anecdotal experience, from talking to some advocates who do some legislative work in this area, if they have somebody who they have that's close to them like that, I think that the legislators suspect bias, and they're worried about what it could look like if they like agree with them, basically. But if it's like a doctor or something, then it's just like, oh, you're a doctor, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So that's something that I've thought about a lot.
Sure.
I would like to jump in here on that. Your question wasn't honed in enough, but there was a button of mine pushed with Smith versus Doe and Justice Kennedy. I'd like to get back to at some point. But but in terms of the message, that's a question that cannot be answered, Andy, because you have to tell me what you want me to do. When you say reform, I need to know what reform you wanted, and you zeroed in a little bit on terms of residence restrictions. But I have relationships with politicians that's probably beyond what the average listener is ever going to have. And the one thing that they will eventually tell you when you have that type of relationship is, you show me how to keep my constituents from killing me on this issue, and I'll help you. And you can never do that when you go in, because you can fall back on is, you say it's the right thing to do, but I'm going to get killed politically. But it's the right thing to do, but I'm going to get killed politically. And you never can help them to overcome the fear that they don't get elected to office because they want to make the life of sex offenders better.
Sure.
They get elected to office because they're concerned about education. They're concerned about public infrastructure. They're concerned about a whole variety of environmental issues, teachers' pensions and whatnot. There's so many things that a state government does that they're involved in. And this is kind of a minor distraction as far as they're concerned. They didn't run on a platform, I'm going to make better life for sex offenders. And when you can't tell them specifically what your plan is and how to keep them from being killed politically, you're not going to get much traction.
So I will. That's, I do want to hop in real quick to just say that I think that that part of this is why, and this is true of a lot of criminal justice issues, not just the registry, but I think that the registry is the most difficult to win on the legislative front. This is why I think that. And, you know, I'm not going to say that I'm an expert at this myself, but I think that I would really like to see some of the reform-minded district attorneys who have been cognizant of unfair sentencing and unfair, you know, quasi-punishments like cash bail in other types of scenarios to, you know, at least start some, like, ideas. Like, say, and I, again, would love to find who that DA was who had, like, a statutory rape diversion, but, like, you know... DAs have an incredible amount of authority and discretion, and people may be upset with individual things that they do, but they already do things that are way more rankling to people, like, you know, just as a part of the job, like, regardless of their reform status. Like, for instance, there was this there's a relatively respected DA out in California, somewhere in the valley. I'm not going to say her name because she, like, you know, like, I don't want to, I think overall she's a good DA, but like this was a bit of a, I don't know how I feel it's yet feel about it, to say the least. But like, there was a case that she got a lot of heat on because, it was a case where a very rich, like 70 something year old man, raped a 5 year old and got like, I think it was like straight up maybe like 90 days house arrest, and that was it, like not even the registry. And we're talking, I mean, like virtually like any, like, I don't know what happened in the case. Maybe the evidence was incredibly weak or something like, or, you know, but, you know, the only thing that was identified in the record was he's old, basically. And so, but like, you know, she didn't even have a challenger like in 2018. And honestly, by 2022, she probably won't, like, you know, like, unless maybe that victim's family, like, talks about it a lot or something. And I'm not necessarily saying, like, that's right. But the point is that, like, you know, you can't judge a DA based on, like, one case or something. But if, like, if I'm right about that and she doesn't, like, basically get knocked out of office, like, for that alone or something, then, like, why can't a DA do, like, a, you know, indecent exposure for the mentally ill diversion or something, you know, to like give them another chance to like not have their life completely destroyed, or like statutory rape, or like non-contact CP offense diversion, or something like that. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, there are.
Well, let's go back to Larry. Larry wanted to circle back around to the Alaska decision.
Oh yeah, right.
The Smith versus Doe, that pushed a button of mine, because it's clearly misunderstood by a lot of people.
Oh yeah,
the facts are established by a variety of mechanisms when cases are in litigation. The frightening and high recidivism was established by the parties in that case. They established that by moving for summary judgment, and when a party moves for summary judgment, which was what happened in the court below, the party that moves for summary judgment, in this case, if I recollect, it may have been there was a joint motion for summary judgment. But when the parties move for summary judgment, whichever party is adverse to the motion, the non-moving party, has the entitlement that everything that they could conceivably present as a defense to why they have the statutory scheme is resolved in favor of them, because there was not a fact-finding mission that takes place, because the parties are saying we don't need a trial. So therefore, when the parties move for summary judgment, the trial court was handed a fact that Alaska said, if we were to go to trial, our defense would be the recidivism is frightening and high. And since the parties were arrogant and didn't want to go to trial and they wanted a summary judgment, the court was handed a fact that there was high and frightening recidivism. And they had to defer to that fact unless they wanted to say, nope, summary judgment was inappropriate. There were material facts in dispute. But otherwise, this was a fact that was established by the parties. And I kind of object to the court being blamed for something that the parties conceded to and stipulated to. You can have stipulated facts, you can have proven facts, and you can have, well, this was a fact that was determined before the case ever reached the Supreme Court, that Alaska's defense was that it would be that there was frightening high recidivism, and that was what the court had to defer to because it was a summary judgment disposition below.
I will jump in to say that I I embarrassingly admit that I actually didn't know that, like, about Smith v. Doe. And you know, I part of the reason that I do the political work that I do rather than just go practice law, I mean, it's one, because I think I have a more macro impact this way on reform. But two, you know, the nitty gritty of like a case dispositions and stuff is not always the thing that's most interesting to me. But in that case, that's a really big deal. And it I don't even think I've seen that in any articles.
No, I only learned of it like a month ago.
I keep saying, but I don't have a big enough platform. There were things that could have been done better, but the parties, that you got to realize that this was late '90s litigation. By the time it reached the Supreme Court, it had been underway for years, because of the trajectory of getting to the high court. But this was late '90s, and no one conceived of, if I were an attorney, had been licensed at that time, I would have just intuitively thought what they did. Well, clearly this is an ex post facto application, but they didn't bother to read Kennedy versus Mendoza Martinez from 1963, which is where the 7-point analysis goes in terms of whether, despite you call it civil and regulatory, whether it inflicts punishment. And the Supreme Court, contrary to everybody on our side who believes that they said something, they didn't say that you can do any registry scheme you can imagine. They said, based on what we see in the Alaska scheme today, it doesn't impose any disabilities or restraints. It doesn't have any occupational debarments. It doesn't restrict the person from traveling. Therefore, this is much like a regulatory scheme related to automobile or something of a common accepted regulatory scheme. They didn't say, legislatures, go out and do anything you want to do, that you have carte blanche. Now, that's what legislators have done. But that's not what the court said. They said that there are boundaries. They said they said, look at these seven factors. And the Sixth Circuit did look at those seven factors, and they said, we find that this evolution of registration requirements, particularly 2006 and 2011 amendments to Michigan SORA, has tipped it beyond what was permissible under the Smith versus Doe analysis. Yeah. And people need to get over this thing about the frightening high recidivism, and they need to get on with the business of proving that the registry has evolved and it inflicts punishment and it's no longer the same analytical framework, and they need to distinguish their facts from the Smith versus Doe facts, and they need to get over it and move on.
I completely agree with that. And, you know, I'll never forget, in law school, I did a paper about what happens when somebody with a serious felony conviction or some other kind of nominally serious conviction applies to try to become an attorney with the state bar. And one of the most fascinating cases to me was Chance Oberstein's in California. He committed an offense that wouldn't be an offense in, you know, the majority of states, but in California it was registrable. And it was a nonviolent, statutory rape type of thing. And, he had to wait 10 years. I mean, I know that you guys probably know about him, but for anyone who doesn't.
Sure, go ahead. A lot of people don't know. Go ahead.
Yeah. So he essentially, public defender in Orange County, California, is in early to mid 30s, and he slept with a 16-year-old, which would be legal in most of the country. He was put on the registry on a felony statutory rape charge, and he spent 10 years doing odd jobs. I remember in one of the articles I read, he drove a 18-wheeler for a while and some other stuff. And so after a lot of time, about a decade, he assembled a portfolio of about 200 character references and went to the California State Bar and was extremely remorseful. He's oh my God, I'm so sorry for what I did. And it was sincere, and they believed he was sincere, and they gave him his bar license back. Even while he was actually on the registry, there was a brief time he ended up getting off 6 months or a year later or something. And so now he practices today to challenge some of the most onerous residency restrictions and stuff like that. But one of the things he told to me was that when I interviewed him for my paper about these some of these issues, was that his life goal is to someday see the Alaska v. Doe decision overturned. And, I think that the reality is, 2018 and beyond is just way different than the late 90s. I mean, anyone who, I even remember, and I'm a relatively young guy, I'm still in my late 20s. The internet, when I was first, experimenting with it in the late 90s as a teenager, it was just the slowest beep boop, awful dial-up connection ever. Back then, maybe it was if somebody's really, really worried about some unsavory behavior from a neighbor or whatever, they can check it or whatever, but it'll take 2 hours. Now it's virtually the first time you Google anybody, if they happen to be on the registry, that's going to be the first thing that pops up. And unless they're somebody with a lot of journalistic bylines or some kind of reentry story that has gotten a lot of press, it may be the only thing that pops up talking about them, which is a pretty damning thing. When people see that and they freak out and they don't care about what the offense is, and everyone gets treated the same, which means getting a job is extremely difficult and things like that. And I mean, I think that anyone who's being honest about the facts will see that things have changed immensely in the last 20 years in terms of technology and how the stigma has evolved with it.
I am with you. Let's move on. Unless Larry, did you want
to? No, we're good. We're good. We're not going to have time to get to all these lovely articles.
I know that.
I'm sorry. I ended up talking a lot.
It's okay. We can run this for 7 hours if you want to.
No one will listen.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's exactly the
problem. We've received a Patreon voicemail as well, and this is from Mike.
Hi, this is Mike A. I'm one of your Patreon subscribers. I have a question for you. I'm a truck driver. Thankfully, I got this job. What types of laws do I have to worry about traveling between states? I mean, that would be a good topic for a podcast for a lot of people who want to travel. Thank you.
I love that question.
Yeah, it's got to impact a pretty fair number of people.
So I don't know if you want. Do you want me to go first?
Larry, go first, please.
Okay. The travel. You run into two issues with travel. You run into state requirements on both sides. The state that you're leaving may have a requirement in the registry scheme that if you're going to be absent from your primary residence for X number of days, that you have to notify them. My state doesn't have that, although law enforcement wishes they did, and they tell people that they have that requirement, and they bamboozle people into giving them information about their plans to leave the state, but there's no such requirement in the statute. But then you have to be worried about the state that you're in, because you can run into a number of hours that would trigger registration requirement, like in Nevada would be as few as 48 hours, and you would have a registration obligation. And although I do not believe that you would have a massive burst of radiation and isotopes that would spew from your body on the 49th hour if you were in Nevada, there are those who believe that they would want to be compliant because the consequences are so extreme. So in Nevada, for example, if you were going to go drop a load and there wasn't going to be another load for you until the 49th hour, you would technically have a registration obligation, whether or not the state that you traveled from required you to give them a notice that you were going to be gone. So you have a complex system where you have to potentially notify the state that you live in that you're going to be absent, and you could conceivably have to notify the state that you're in that you're there and have to register, and then you may register in a state like Florida where they would never remove your name from the list. And if you were registered in Vermont and you went down to Florida, although Vermont will remove you, Florida will never remove you. So the vestiges of the registry would follow you for the remainder of your days, unless the Florida law changes.
Let me ask you this question, though. And Nevada being a pretty vast state, that this would be harder to do. But if you go to a place like Reno, where you're really close to the edge of it, could you conceivably go drop your load and then drive out of the state and like touch the next state over and then come back? And now you have reset the 48-hour clock?
You could argue that. I would have to look at the Nevada statute to give a lay opinion, since I'm not licensed to practice, but you could certainly argue that. And sometimes we don't know the answer to questions. People say, well, why don't you know the answer? Because that hasn't been litigated, and it's a matter of first impression. Does the statute say 48 continuous hours, or does it say 48 hours cumulative? What does it mean? It may be that no one knows, but I know the fear of some that they really are paranoid about the seven. We had the conference in Cleveland, and there were people who left on the 71st hour because they didn't want to be in violation of the 72-hour window that they thought they would have to register according to their interpretation of Ohio law.
And just something to bring up is that this is a podcast with two non-lawyers, and you should never take legal advice from definitely two non-lawyers. But we're just giving you our best guess, or you know, whatever.
Minnesota, but but yeah, no. What I have to add to that is, yeah, I was actually thinking the same thing, and I think that obviously a lot of things would have to the planets would have to align, so to speak, and that you'd have to have a DA thinking that it's worth charging somebody. And then also say if somebody just like, you know, went up to the 49th hour or something and then left. Why would they do that? And also, like, what if they discover it like 5 years later? Like, different states have like different statutes of limitations for those sorts of crimes. I know that North Carolina, for instance, is really bizarre because there's actually no felony statute of limitations, period. Every single felony in the book can be prosecuted forever, which is just super weird. It's the only state that I know of that's like that.
So Larry, Maryland, add that to your list.
I was just going to say, so if you did this sort of, you know, concocted, if you were there for the 49th hour, whatever Maryland has, but you're in a state that has removed the statute of limitations, and someone comes up like, oh my God, you were in the state for 49 hours, and they discover this 10 years later, they could ostensibly say, psh, we're coming after you?
They could.
It would be difficult. I think that any DA who would even try that would probably be just trying to coerce a plea deal, which, you know, obviously virtually all cases do come out on plea deal. But the thing is, with with, you know, registry violation offenses tend to be a low level felony, which, like, you know, depending on criminal record, may see a couple of years on the state level. The feds are definitely going to get prison time, but they would never, I would be shocked if they took a case like that. So it would probably just be like an overzealous DA trying to make their name for themselves. But if the person turned around and said, I'm not pleading to Jack.
Right.
They had to take that to trial. I mean, I can't imagine, unless you had somebody who was literally stalking somebody for 49 hours, which would in of itself likely be a criminal offense, depending on the circumstances, or it could be arguably like
we've talked about the statute of limitations here before and how it's just such a really bad idea. I'd never really considered like this little kind of benign situation of you trying to juggle the whole situation of trying to literally do a job. And you end up in and out of the state, possibly crossing the line by a minute or an hour. And 10, 20, 50 years later, you're sitting there, you know, in your old age home, rocking back to some Golden Girls reruns. And they come knock on your door and lock you up because of something you did when you were 20 driving a truck from a sexual offense.
Right. I have to imagine that, like, part of it is that the legislators, you know, like, I've heard from some registrants that are friends and colleagues that they do suspect that part of it is them just, you know, obviously trying to make life as miserable as possible. And like, who knows? Maybe a lot of the legislators don't even want people on the registry to work. They just want them to sit there and be miserable and like have no money. But that's also extremely foolish, like, let alone just like the human dignity, like issues and like the, you know,
such a cynical view of society.
Yeah, it's a horrible view, and it's not a practicable view. It also does not comport with American values.
Larry,
so
I agree. The this would be a long shot prosecution, but what I've learned being in the law for a number of years is that anything that can happen will happen. There will be a overzealous prosecution. There will be when tools are misused. If you give them something in their arsenal. It's been my experience that arsenal will be discharged at some point. And then my philosophy is don't give them any tool in their arsenal because we cannot trust them. When any time a prosecutor says, give us discretion, we won't abuse it, you should run for the hills.
Right.
And I would respond one thing about the being a relatively low-level felony. You're comparing relatively progressive Minnesota with relatively progressive New Mexico, where it's a low-level felony. It's a low-level felony in both of our states, and it's largely going to be a probated sentence here. But go to Oklahoma. You got a mandatory minimum, I believe, of 3 years for a violation of registry in Oklahoma. I may be off. It may be 2 years, but there's a mandatory incarceration in some of these states. So it's not such a low-level felony.
That doesn't surprise me, there are obviously some liberal states where, you know, on certain kinds of crimes generally involving like sex crimes or guns or whatever, where certain punishments are like, you know, higher than, say, in some conservative states. But generally across the board, a state like Oklahoma is, you know, just going to try to lock up everybody for as long as possible. And I mean, you know, it is interesting. They did just take over from Louisiana as the most incarcerated state and the most incarcerated nation in the world.
Yes,
aka the prison capital.
Louisiana fell down to number two now, according to our guest on the podcast. But it's a serious felony. Like in our state, it's specifically, it cannot be used as habitual. You could have 38 felony convictions or whatever number you could possibly write up in your life, and if you get charged with a registry violation, there is no habitual for that. That is carved out as an exemption. It's since it's a regular scheme, but in most states I've examined, it can be lumped in together. So if you have two prior felonies, they can use it, or whatever triggers a habitual
felony enhancement.
Yeah. They can't do that with registry. Now the registry violation itself, it has a self enhancer on the second violation. They can charge you with one degree higher felony. It's rather than a fourth degree, they can charge you as a third. But they largely bargain that back down to the first. If you'll plead, they'll say, well, we got you on a third degree, which we can give you up to 3 years. If you'll plead, we'll give you a fourth degree and we'll give you 18 months, which you'll do 9. And but it's mostly probation in our state. If it's a technical violation of some time, like you've missed the number of days before your update. If you totally abscond from registering and they have to go out and track you down, you might get jail time, but it's largely treated with probation.
Yeah, basically you'd have to try for it. Yeah. And I think that like those disparities, you know, it's a big problem with the way that laws are written in different states. priorities of different state legislatures. But I think that the thing is, going back to kind of just like the DA issue, is that, you know, there's also a lot of discretion on how they apply these sorts of things. You know, really somebody, especially somebody who, like, regardless of whether or not one believes in any kind of registry, you know, they have discretion on how they charge that and, like, what they're going to charge. And, like, you know, if it's, like, somebody who literally just, like, forgets or makes a mistake or something, no, there's literally no reason that any DA should be asking for incarceration for that.
That absolutely.
Unless it's, like, mandatory in the statute and they want to prosecute.
Yeah, but even if it's mandatory in the statute, why is it mandatory in the statute?
Well,
I was going to say, except in states where there's a mandatory incarceration, but if they don't bring the charge, then there's no incarceration.
Exactly. That's my point. Yeah.
But there again, it reflects to who we are as a people. We had a candidate in 2016 that ran for president and said, I will be the law and order candidate. And his attorney general is reversing every policy that was put in place to reduce the prison incarceration. Everything from canceling contracts with reintegration halfway houses to closing halfway houses to filing the maximum charge, seeking the maximum penalty, and filing every habitual enhancement. That's what he said he was going to do. Well, yeah. He won the election. That's what happens when you elect a district attorney. You got two candidates. You got one saying that I'm a little more progressive and I want to look for alternatives. You got another one saying, I believe they should pay dearly and I'm going to prosecute and seek the maximum. Why is it that the one that seeks the maximum always gets elected, except in a rare instance like in Philadelphia and a few cases where the more progressive? Why is it that the people elect the one who promises to be the harshest? Is that not who we are?
Right. I think the tide is slowly starting to change because of, you know, really, really good reporting and, you know, advocacy and podcasts and other sorts of media regarding how broken our criminal justice system is. But I think it's obviously very, very slow. I think that you are right about Jeff Sessions. I mean, you're definitely right about, like, what President Trump said. The ironic thing, and, you know, there's been some more revelations and one could believe them or not. But, like, the thing is, you know, I don't necessarily think that prosecution would be appropriate in the stuff I've heard if that's all that was going on. But, like, you know, in a lot of places, you know, if he were just a normal dude, he could have been charged. I mean, like, you know, California has a law where, you know, if somebody, like, it's basically written, from my understanding at least, it's like the child annoyance statute, but it's like, you know, like sexual stuff. And I think that the registration is discretionary. I'd have to check. But the point is, it's basically like, did you hit on somebody under 18, regardless of your knowledge they were under 18?
Yes.
Like, what? I mean, like under that law, and it's a misdemeanor, but still, like, yeah, I mean, like, Trump probably could have been prosecuted for that if he were in California when he, like, you know, hit on, like, the 15-year-old, like, you know, teen, like, USA models or whatever. But, like, he's the president. The ironic thing is I wish that the ironic thing is that people don't seem to care. Basically.
Well, and of course, I only hit Trump on his policies. I don't get into all the stuff about what he might have done.
Right.
I hit him squarely on policy. I disagree with Mr. Trump on his policies. I don't criticize for Melania what her jacket said or what she might be eating or what her jewelry might be, or the kind of things they did about Obama. I disagree with him on his policies that he's pursuing. He's pursuing policies that have failed in every way that they've been tried, and we're cocking our head and hoping we're going to get a different result this time. Massive tax cuts followed by massive increase in spending has always driven the deficit through the sky. It will do so again.
Right.
It will lead to inflation, overheating the economy. We'll go into recession just like we did in 2008. The question is when. His criminal justice stuff is going to lead to a larger prison population, more people incarcerated, more people disenfranchised. I disagree with Mr. Trump on his policy, his selection of attorney general. It has nothing to do with him about what he might have done, who he might have pinched, although if any of those allegations are true, I find them distasteful. But I disagree with him on policy.
Oh yeah,
and I try to focus it to the policy rather than all these nuances that they hit Obama about his tan suit or the things that they tried to find that he might have been a Muslim or all this kind of stuff, or whether he was a citizen or whether he was born in Hawaii and all this. I mean, it was just a nonstop attacks. I don't find that to be a productive, and I'm not going to do that against President Trump. I'm going to attack his policies. I disagree with his policies.
So I just want to clarify quickly that I meant that as a non-political statement, in the sense that, like, hypothetically, if somebody of immense wealth and political influence, one person could do something that an overzealous DA could construe as a criminal offense that they wouldn't against somebody of a certain social stature, but may go after, like, the stupid, 18-year-old that no one cares about or something, that's my point. Like, and I think that, like, those sorts of arguments, it definitely is the kind of thing that applies more to the liberal base than, like, the conservative base. When it comes to criminal justice politics, especially, I really wish that we could be more even more nonpartisan about it. I think that that there is often a lot of arguing past each other. But I do think that there is potential for growth. And I do believe that it should genuinely be a nonpartisan issue.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I agree that we probably should move on with these articles, or we're going to really go long.
Oh, yeah.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Let's move on. So we have two good articles, good news articles tonight. And the first one is from the Texas Observer, making the case against banishing sex offenders. The cool thing in this article, and it magically tied into what was being discussed tonight, is it is, political suicide for a politician to say, yes, I'm pro sex offender. But in this article, they are going after it from a judicial side and gaining success in that direction.
So, and we should give a shout out to Mary Sue, who was
Absolutely.
Quoted in this article. Mary so Sue Mulner and Robin from Narsal and Mary Sue from Texas Voices. I don't know where to start. I mean, it's just such a comprehensive article about how none of this stuff works, but yet we keep doing it.
But I got a quote for you, and I think you'll know what it is. And it's just like the football coach said, I'm just trying to win football games. If our objective is to reduce the impact of the registry, it doesn't matter whether you beg, borrow, or steal. But if you can get it done at the legislature, great. If you can legislature, great. If you can get it done in the judicial side, then that's great too.
That's correct, and they're doing a little bit of both, and they won some challenges in Texas, which the legislature promptly undid by giving the general law cities the power to do what the home rule cities, I believe what they're called, the larger cities, were able to do. They gave them the same powers, and so now they, rather than them being able to preempt them through the lack of the general law cities having that power, now they're going to have to attack them through the judicial process, because it's very difficult to come in and I told them this was a losing hand when they argued this. It's very difficult to come in and say, well, the big city should be able to do it, but the smaller city shouldn't. That's not a winning hand when you're dealing with elected politicians. The rural voters don't understand why they shouldn't have those powers. If sex offenders are so dangerous that Dallas and Houston can limit where they live, why can't we?
One thing that was brought up in the article, and I'm trying to find exactly where I copied the clip, but it's they talked about that this touches the banishment and shaming, and does that gain any ground at the judicial level where you are effectively making a whole area off limits? Does that become unconstitutional? I think we've talked about that it's not exactly unconstitutional.
It's a tough sell, because with the literal interpretation, it's judicial doctrine. If you believe in the evolving standard of decency in terms of how the Constitution should be interpreted, then you're likely, at least for this issue, to be more of a liberal progressive. That's the Earl Warren, Abe Fortas, the liberal wing of the court that believed that we evolved. A conservative like a Neil Gorsuch or Antonin Scalia will say, we're sorry, but the Constitution doesn't evolve. We look at what those words were and what they would have meant at the time they were written. And the conservative view would be that banishment, if you look at that and say, argue banishment, you would have to look at what banishment as it was understood by the founders. And banishment would have been when a person was forbidden to be in the community. Well, these prohibitions don't, you were told to leave town, never come back, or something bad's going to happen to you. You're banished. You couldn't come shop. You couldn't come do anything. Well, the residency restrictions don't tell you that you can't shop and spend your money there.
If there's a bouncy house there, you might be.
You can come spend $30,000 and buy yourself a vehicle if you have it. You can do a lot of things. You just can't live on the exclusion zone. That is not banishment in the conservative viewpoint if you take a literal view of interpreting the Constitution. So the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, based in New Orleans, which covers Texas, with the city of Louisville versus the case of Duarte, which Richard Gladden, attorney that was affiliated with Texas Voices, he litigated that case all the way to the Fifth Circuit and filed a cert petition with the U.S. Supreme Court. And they didn't find 97-98% of Louisville being off limits constituted banishment because They said, we look at the literally meaning of what banishment meant in those days. That's the same view the 11th Circuit is likely to take on the case where the similar arguments being made in the case of McGuire out of Alabama. So if you believe in conservative judicial doctrine, you're probably not going to get the outcome you're wanting from the courts on this issue, because banishment is not banishment in terms of what colonial founders were thinking when they used those words.
Rory?
Yeah, no, I think that is definitely true. I do think that there have been some interesting when there has been more than one issue, more than one demographic that can be afflicted potentially by. Well, cut that. I'm trying to say that. I was shocked and pleasantly surprised when there was a 9-0 decision in North Carolina.
Packingham.
Exactly. Yeah. Where they took an evolving standard of, First Amendment rights and what it means to actually have a voice in the public discourse to essentially say that people on the registry should be allowed to be on social media because that's essentially the major place where political discourse happens nowadays.
Certainly.
And so the opposing argument to that was actually, like what you'd expect, the conservative legal base to buy into, which is this idea of, well, hey, like the New York Times has a comment section for like over-18s or something.
Yep.
And like even the conservative justices in that case were like, nope, that's absurd. Like who actually chooses to only dialogue on the New York Times, and like who reads those comments versus checking Facebook or Twitter like a normal person?
Well, there's an article coming up that sort of touches on this too. There are many places that will require they'll do Facebook authentication, so you can only comment on the blog if you have a Facebook account. Well, most of our people cannot have a Facebook account. We are excluded from that.
Well, just remember that the conservative wing of the court did caution about the expansiveness of that Packingham ruling. They were not happy with the liberals because they said this is runaway dicta here that's going to come back to haunt us because the liberals. So the conservatives were very cautious. I mean, they to their credit, I have to give them credit, they were on the right side of the issue in terms of their blanket prohibition, but they were very cautious about because they realized we're going to use Packingham to do a hell of a lot of litigation. And we're chomping at the bit to use that dicta, but that was the difference between the liberal wing and the conservative wing. The conservative wing would probably still got a victory, but we wouldn't have an expansive victory like we think we have with Packingham. Right. Because we think we're going to be able to do a lot of good things with it over the coming years.
True.
Mm-hmm. And let's hop on down to the next one, which is, has plea bargaining pushed the Sixth Amendment right to trial to the brink of extinction? And this is from witnessla.com.
Mm-hmm.
I captured a paragraph in here. It says, defendants still have the choice of whether or not to go to trial, but of course, they have the right to go to trial, of course, but according to the studies and exoneration data the report points to, the fears and pressures defendants commonly face in the plea bargaining process are so overwhelming that in an alarming number of instances, innocent people decide to plead guilty to crimes they did not commit. That drives me crazy, man. That's just scary.
Mm-hmm.
And I've met a good number of people that they say they're innocent. I don't care what, they say they are. I just take it with that. And they took a plea deal because the DA was throwing, say, 40 years at them, and they just took a 10-year plea deal instead. Better to take the 10 versus the risk of the 40 that you don't.
Right, certainly. No, it's certainly true. And a lot has been made out of the concept of the trial penalty. And I think when it comes to sex cases in particular, even with the horrible aspects of, the horrible implications of being on the registry, which, I think that unfortunately a lot of people don't know unless they're like a legal policy junkie, right, or like somebody who knows somebody directly affected, like how very terrible it is.
Yeah.
They're told, hey, you can like go home, or like, I'm going to prosecute you to the fullest extent and recommend like 10 years if you're found guilty on this one charge or something. And yeah. I mean, of course somebody's going to take probation in the registry. I mean, even if they know like how awful it is, like, they may think like naively in most cases, like, oh, like it'll get fixed someday. And like, that's right. Just like, fortunately right. Not like that's, rarely how it works.
Larry, what do you have?
I was just going to chime in on the numbers. People think that the numbers are so dramatically different. And according to a report released by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, 3% of cases in the federal system go to trial and 6% in the state go to trial. So it's not, I mean, it's twice as many, it's 100% more, but 3% and 6% of 100% whole is not a large amount. But even 30 years ago, it was only 1/5 of the cases. If you go down, they say that 30 years ago, federal defendants chose to go to trial 20% of the time. But that was right about the time when we did Criminal Justice Reform Act of the early 80s, which fully kicked in the late 80s, but they started working on it around 84. The parole was abolished. Good time was all but abolished, 52, 54 days per year, 85% is what a person serves. And then the penalty for going to trial was enhanced by that's under the sentencing guidelines. That's a denial of responsibility. So if you go to trial and get convicted, then you're still in denial and haven't accepted responsibility. So you get additional points on the sentencing grid that the feds came up with. And that was all done in the 80s during the Reagan administration. And it's unfortunate. It's going to be very difficult to undo that. We were making some progress in 2016 until that progress halted in the campaign when the Law and Order president surfaced as being the likely nominee. Some good Republicans that were willing to stick their neck out backed away when they realized that the likely nominee did not support that. It's going to be tough. This lock them up, throw away the key mentality, and punish people for going to trial, you're not going to see those numbers go up anytime soon. I think you just referred to it as the penalty, the trial penalty.
Yeah,
it's just astronomical. If you go to trial and lose, you have the certainty. But what really troubles me on this is that, as bad as it is for felonies, and believe me, it's plenty bad, it's even worse for misdemeanors, because the breakneck pace that they push misdemeanor cases through means that you probably see your attorney, if you're indigent, on the day that you're going to do the plea, and you have precious little time to talk about collateral consequences, and misdemeanors can have extreme collateral consequences. Get a domestic violence and find out what happens to you in terms of your gun, your precious gun ownership rights. Yeah. And any misdemeanor can be a deportation ticket, in particular under this administration, because they've instructed the Department of Justice to deport anybody for anything and to have a no holds barred approach. So all these misdemeanors that are pleading guilty, because they want to get out of jail. They had a $500 bond, which goes back to the earlier segment where you're talking about trying to do with cash bail to replace it with an expensive GPS monitoring system, of course, that the person can't afford while they're on pretrial, which is another conversation for another podcast. But they couldn't pay the $500,000 bond. So they plead guilty to credit time served. They find themselves deported, or they find themselves with a collateral consequence that lasts for life that no one told them about.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of misdemeanors out there that are registrable. And, you know, in the four states, well, now three, if you don't count California, though, that's not going to kick into effect until 2021, I believe. So like those four states, it's like, oh, somebody, you know, has one indecent exposure misdemeanor on their record. And, you know, we've decided that is that the worst case scenario with that charge entails a year in jail, rather than, you know, any kind of felony level penalties, which are over a year. And even so, we're going to label somebody for life, like just completely obliterate, like, you know, a lot of the opportunities and, you know, relationships that they would otherwise have over that, you know? And so that's, and you know, like people just, you know, often in the sex offense realm will be given the, you know, here's the felony that I can, you know, probably get you a trial for, you know, if for nothing else, the jury wants to convict you on this. And jury selection is a very complex thing, but, you know, it's a pretty rigged system. Like, you know, if you have jurors who express skepticism about the fairness of the justice system, they're going to be out of there in a second. Or you could just like plead to this misdemeanor and get probation for a year, but you know, say goodbye to a normal life anyway. So,
all right. Well, we have an article that shows just how wonderful a group of people we are. And it's from The Intercept again. Tennessee plans to restart executions by killing a man with mental illness. And I don't want to discount that the guy did a pretty horrendous crime. But if you are a person that grows up in an environment where your mom ties you up with a rope and beats you, I don't necessarily know that that's an enriching environment that you could expect someone to grow up and be an overly productive person of society. But then here we are. He's on death row and he is possibly going to be executed later this year with a controversial drug to go with it. Larry, what do you think?
I put that article in there for that very reason. There was an underlying sexual offense, so I could draw a weak connection. But it speaks more to who we are as a people, and I get death threats every time I say this, but a compassionate society in Europe would never consider executing a person like this. Of course, they don't execute people in European nations anyway. But it says something about who we are in this country when 30 some odd states still have the death penalty on their books. I think it is. I mean, we every couple of years we might get another state to add to the no death penalty list. But to put a person that has this type of condition to death, to me, is beneath the dignity of America. But yet we're going full steam ahead to do it, and I think that kind of reflects if we can't bring ourselves. The sex offender community is perceived as being the most despised of all criminals. And I guess somebody who'd done murder and a sex offense, I would make you double indemnity. But if we can't find ourselves in our heart to have a little bit of compassion for this situation, then our cause isn't going to go very far. Because society, if we're that heartless, there's not going to be any room for a lot of reform for having second chances for people who've transgressed in a sexual offense of some type.
Sure. Hey, Rory, do you have a quickly?
Yeah.
I want to get through these last couple articles before we tip the timer scale.
Right, for sure. That makes perfect sense. I think that that's I agree with some of that. I think that the capital murder statutes tend to be pretty clinical about and, you know, this is because of legislation. They generally quabble over what qualifies as aggravating factors that are appropriate for DA to seek the death penalty based on. And generally murder of a child is going to be one of them. Sexually motivated murder is yet another one. And yeah, I mean, like, frankly, you know, I've gone over hundreds of capital cases when I was at Fair Punishment Project. It continues to be a big area of interest for me. And yeah, I mean, like, that's going to be a really difficult case to get on any kind of, like, you know, a life verdict, regardless of the horrible life that this person has lived with severe mental illness. But I think that that even though people don't necessarily talk about it, you know, there are a lot more people. I suspect that there are more people who would be okay with this guy being executed than, say, somebody having their life obliterated for a one flashing conviction or a statutory rape or like looking at a couple of, you know, nudes of like a 16-year-old or something along those lines. Now, if it's a more serious offense, yeah, obviously that's a more difficult sell. But I think that I think that's definitely like a difficulty on like how to approach registry reform as well. And it's not I don't really see it as like my place, you know, to recommend like what like I think, because I'm not somebody who's directly impacted by these laws. But I think that they're unfair for people who have committed even much more serious offenses in a lot of cases. But basically, yeah, it's like do we do piecemeal to try to like knock certain like low level sex offenses off the registry rosters, or do we try to abolish it in general? And, you know, it's like that whole debate. And I don't really want to wade into that. But I think that it does definitely depress me that we don't, have at least some compassion, at least in some states, for people who have like schizophrenia or bipolar or something and commit a murder. But I will say that over the last several years, we have definitely truncated how often the death penalty is being used. Where it used to be like hundreds of death sentences a year, it's now in the 30s generally.
Sure.
Which is a big improvement, generally speaking.
And on the last article, this is the second good article of the night, and it is from the York Times. From the York News Times. That's hard to say when you're used to saying New York Times. Sex offender residency restrictions dropped by council. And this comes from a friend of the show who sent in the article by email. And the article talks about an ordinance that would have banned convicted registered sex offenders from living within 500 feet. It's such a low number from my perception. Yeah. But 500 feet of a school or childcare facility in York was given a second public reading, but then it was dropped. And I think that, Larry, you could chime in with some really interesting points about this. The data was looked at by the city council, and they just said it doesn't do anything to make the community safer.
But not being on the ground in York, I don't know exactly what happened. I'm hoping that the Nebraskans Unafraid went and talked to the counselors prior to the meeting and shared another point of view with them and the evidence. And the evidence is crystal clear. Now, what they were looking at that was troubling the person who wanted the ordinance was that the number of sex offenders living in York had doubled from 15 to 31. And that means we're being overrun with them. Overrun. And we need to do something to protect our children. And York sits just off Interstate 80. I've been through there a number of times. And it's a small place, a couple of hotels, but not a very large city. And they looked at it and said, we've got better things to do. Kudos to the council for common sense prevailing and looking at the evidence. And thanks for the work that hopefully was done by the group in Nebraska. I think they call themselves Nebraskans Unafraid.
Excellent. And one thing that stood out to me in the article is that the schools and child care facilities, people would be displaced, and that would be a problem for families, said Council Member Matt Wagner. There's no evidence that they are recommending these crimes. Excuse me. There's no evidence that what they're recommending that they do, that these crimes were found to be actually more detrimental by imposing the restriction and, I guess, essentially going back to the whole banishment conversation we had.
Yeah. And he's talking about recidivism there. So yeah, there's no evidence that they are recommitting the crimes. And so why displace people and make them, just more miserable for no reason, basically.
Yeah, I
think that's a really impressive decision. And I think that it took some level of political bravery. And I think that hopefully it's a sign of things to come when more city councils are having this information put before them and they're actually reading it. Frankly.
I suspect that they wouldn't have come to the conclusion unless, like Larry said, the affiliate or the group up there, if they hadn't presented them with the information, they wouldn't have sought it.
There was a success
story in Texas where there was a suburb of Houston, which the name is escaping me, but they had a civil ordinance tabled that had been sponsored by everybody. And then once they look at the evidence, thanks to the work that Texas Voices did, once they looked at it, the sponsors backed away from it. These battles can be won. Thankfully, we don't have to fight them here because cities and counties don't have the authority to do that under our state statutory scheme. They're not allowed to have such ordinances. So we don't spend one ounce of energy trying to prevent these things from passing because they don't possess the power to pass them.
Right. That makes sense.
Well, that's all I have. Larry, is there anything else that you wanted to cover?
Well, I always want to cover things, but we don't have any more time on this episode.
Well, Rory,
go ahead. I've gotten some good feedback about the interstate translation. A couple of people said it was very helpful.
That was complicated.
That
is some propeller head stuff right there.
It really is. It shouldn't be that complicated.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to write an article for the newsletter, but we got a couple of comments directly to me, but I don't know what you might have gotten from through the regular channels.
I got a whole lot of FYPs.
What's the FYP?
I can't say it. It's a family program.
Oh, you know what it is.
FYP Studios.
We need to name ourselves like the EIB Network for excellence in broadcasting.
Yes,
we need to be the FYP Network.
I absolutely am going to go incorporate that. Well, Rory, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it. How can people reach out to you and get in touch with you?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm on Twitter at RoryFleming8A, at symbol RoryFleming with 1M8A, and I'm pretty visible on there.
About your website?
Yeah, and so my website for Foglight Strategies, my consulting firm, is Foglight, Foglight, Strategies, StrategiesST.org. It should really be a .com, but I do also have my blog on Medium, The Protector's Digest, which often what I do there is essentially, talk about what prosecutors across America are doing and what their records look like, which I think that there has been some move to make that that kind of information more public, but it's a lot less out there than people might expect in terms of people actually writing this stuff. I think a lot of people fear writing about VAs, basically, frankly. So that's the digest on Medium, or also known as The Protector's Digest. That's on Twitter as well. You can find it on my page.
Outstanding. Well, thank you again so much for joining us. And for all of you out there, you can please share the podcast with those you know, and we can continue to grow our audience. And we continue to receive a lot of positive feedback and really appreciate it. And we will talk to you soon. Have a good night, Larry. Wow. Thank you again, Rory.
Of course. My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you.
Good night, Rory. Good night, Andy.
Night.